From the studios of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas, this is Arkansas Ozarks African Americans 1820 to 1950. I'm your host, Pete Hartman. In part one of Arkansas Ozarks African Americans, narrator Julia Rose Sampson guides us into the rugged Ozarkian frontier through antebellum enslavement, emancipation, mandated segregation, racial oppression, and finally, into independence.
Happy Hollow.
Traveling northward by wagon away from fever-ridden lowland delta settlements and westward toward new land, white migrant slaveholders first arrived in the southwestern Ozarks Territory in 1826. These pioneers found a mild climate, fertile grassland, oak barrens, and deep valleys thick with walnut, elm, honey locust, wild grapes, and blackberries. Small plantations, sawmills, and flour mills, many worked by slave labor, soon appeared on the landscape. Washington County history writer Joe Neal.
In those areas where there were rich productive soils, slave owners could in fact participate in the slave economy that existed all over the southern United States.
A few large plantations maintained dozens of slaves, while many single-family homesteads kept one or two slaves. Arkansas history professor Dr. Nudy Williams.
Most people do not associate African-American, indeed, as a population. Neither do they associate slavery with Northwest Arkansas.
One of the earliest migrants to legally establish a homestead were the Lattas from South Carolina. A Latta family history described the contributions of two slaves known only as Ben and Dan.
They were great, powerful, shining black Negroes of a tribe not like the rest of grandfather's slaves. My mother used to say they were each more than 6 feet, 3 inches in height and resembled Nubians. They had been trained by grandfather John Latta and were the finest mechanics ever to come into the country. Excellent blacksmiths, wheelwrights, wagon makers, carpenters, and stonemasons. Grandfather used to hire Ben and Dan out to surrounding settlers.
Other early slave-owning families included the Pyatts, Buchanans, Evans, Funkhausers, Wilsons, Parks, Hannahs, and Weddingtons. Large slaveholders dominated the region, including two plantation owners, David Walker, whose land lay in a southeastern valley of what was to become Fayetteville, and Mark Bean of Cane Hill, who also operated a salt works on the Illinois River. Ted Smith, executive director of the Southern Cultural Heritage Foundation in Vicksburg, Mississippi, is one of only a few scholars who have studied Arkansas Ozarks slavery.
There was not a large cash economy in the Ozarks before the American Civil War. So slaves in the Ozarks worked on small farms, raising foodstuffs like corn, wheat, and oats, and tending to livestock.
Communities such as Cane Hill, Evansville, Hawkeye, Summers, and Cincinnati were built using the labor of over 800 male slaves. Typical farms, averaging 300 acres, featured a log main house, smokehouse, spring house, corn crib, and barn. While separate slave quarters were constructed away from the main house, such as on the Bean Plantation, which built 8 cabins to accommodate their slaves, some kinship between blacks and whites did develop. Dr. Gordon Morgan, a University of Arkansas sociology professor, has researched and written extensively on the region's black history.
If you brought a young child and then the child grew up with the family as a slave, that would be entirely different from purchasing somebody from Biloxi, Mississippi, that is adult and brought into the area.
Fayetteville soon became known as the slaveholding capital of the Ozarks. Fully one-third of the population, numbering over 600, were enslaved, laboring in the fields, factories, shops, and homes. Ozarks black history scholar Ted Smith.
And that really is an interesting dynamic, I think, for a mountain, a city in the mountains, to have that significant of a percentage of its population to have been slaves. It's a high percentage, and I think part of that it can be accounted for farms around Fayetteville and the number of farms that were so close to Fayetteville that the line really becomes blurred between urban and rural in this time in the early 19th century.
Prominent Fayetteville slave owners were Robert Graham, a minister who would found Arkansas College, the precursor to the University of Arkansas, newspaper editor William Smith, and J.L. Dixon, a wealthy merchant. Considered and taxed as personal property, slaves were not allowed to freely move about, congregate without permission, were prohibited from education and from carrying weapons, even for self-protection. They generally enjoyed only one day off, Sunday, which was spent taking care of family chores, and for the children, a time to play. Adeline Blakely, a slave of John Parks who owned a farm on a stagecoach trail near Hawkeye, recalled playing with Parks' white daughter, Fanny. Teresa Hoover reads Adeline's account.
We didn't have many toys. Maybe a doll made from a corn cob, with a dress made from scraps, and a head made from a roll of scraps. We were playing church. Miss Fanny was the preacher, and I was the audience. We were singing, "Jesus May All to Heaven Go." When we were halfway through our song, we discovered that the passengers from the stagecoach stopped to listen. We were so frightened at our audience that we both ran, but we were coaxed to come back for a dime and sing our song over. I remember that Miss Fanny used a big leaf for a book.
Those who broke slave codes were made as an example. Word of an exceptionally brutal slave beating at Cane Hill Township spread throughout the state. After Isaac Spencer had purchased a female slave away from her children, the young mother ran away four times to be with them. Local historian Joe Neal.
The woman was supposedly mentally unsound. According to the court record, and now I'm quoting from the court record, a few days after Spencer bought the slave, he was found whipping her. He had her stripped and staked down on the ground, her feet and hands extended and fastened to stakes, her face upwards. He appeared calm and was whipping her at intervals using a cowhide with a plaited lash about 15 inches long. He asked her what made her do so. Maybe it was to run away. And she said that Bedford and Buchanan told her that if she stayed there, she would be whipped to death. Spencer had drawn back some blood, but not a great deal. He took salt in a cob and salted her back.
Much like agricultural commodities, enslaved African Americans were bought and sold for profit. From an 1800s deed record, grantors listed transference of the following, quote, items, unquote.
One Negro woman, Ellen, aged about 24, for $400. One Negro girl, Betsy, age 11 years, for $375. One Negro boy named Henry, for $301. Negroes Jane, George, Hiffa, Sally, Lewis, Charles, and their increase for $400.
The notion of enslaving groups of humans in America can be traced to Southern cultural perceptions that blacks were not only inferior, they were incapable of living independent lives. Slavery was also considered biblically sound, thus morally justified. Because the sparsely settled Ozark Highlands had limited law enforcement, slaves could easily run away and remain at large without fear of capture. Adeline Blakely, a slave of John Parks who owned a farm on a stagecoach trail near Hawkeye, told of township patrols she called patty rolls who watched for runaways.
Yes, we were afraid of the patty rolls. All colored folks were. They said that any Negroes that were caught away from their master's premise without a permit would be whipped by the patty rolls. They used to sing a song, "Run, Nigger, Run, the Patty Rolls Will Get You."
The case of a runaway Fayetteville slave, Nelson Hackett, created an international incident. A 30-year-old single man, reportedly of a refined and self-possessing nature, Hackett served as butler and valet to plantation owner and merchant Alfred Wallace. In the summer of 1841, Hackett stole Wallace's horse, along with some valuables, and made his way north, where he joined 12,000 other American slave refugees who had found asylum in abolitionist Canadian territory. Arkansas Governor Archibald Yell, himself a slave owner, demanded Hackett's extradition on charges of theft. By the following summer, an Arkansas posse had apprehended Hackett and returned him to Wallace. Ted Smith.
It was very rare for a slave to escape to Canada and to make it all the way to Canada from northwest Arkansas is intriguing in its uniqueness to me.
Anti-slavery legislators in both the British and Canadian Parliament questioned the validity of the case and deemed that criminal extradition could no longer be a method for legal abduction of slaves who had sought freedom on Canadian soil. The so-called Arkansas extradition incident became a precedent in protecting the civil rights of runaway slaves. Independent African Americans found it almost impossible to settle in the Ozarks. In 1843, the Arkansas legislature barred free blacks from migrating into the state, a move to deter runaways from finding refuge in the mountains. And 13 years later, in 1860, a law made it illegal for freed blacks to remain in the state. If they did not leave, they were forced into servitude to pay for their deportation. When the deportation law went into effect, the number of free blacks in the state had plummeted from 608 to less than 100. Ted Smith.
I think that free blacks, there were free blacks that left the state of Arkansas as a result of it, but as far as the importance of that, it's very difficult to gauge. There were not many free blacks in the Arkansas Ozarks in the first place.
47 free blacks had managed to purchase small farms in Washington County. Among them, Elijah Williams had attained the status of an attorney and worked in Fayetteville. The Butterfield Overland Stage passed through Fayetteville by this time, serving over 15,000 residents living in Washington County. Among them were 1,500 slaves, over half of them women. Because of the scarcity of white female settlers, a number of Ozarks men took enslaved women as mates, siring a new generation of mixed-blood offspring. With the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861, the Arkansas Ozarks were deeply and sometimes violently divided in allegiance toward the Union and Confederacy. Arkansas history professor Dr. Nudy Williams.
What we see on the eve of the Civil War, there was a furious debate in the Ozark because you're talking about the independent-mindedness and because they were not as dependent upon a slave population to do the work. Most people pride themselves in being not only independent, but they will work independent. And so therefore, they had no vested interest.
Hundreds of Arkansas freemen and runaway slaves, wanting to fight firsthand for liberation, joined the Union ranks. Some enlisted with the 1st Arkansas Colored Regiment Infantry, others with the 1st and 2nd Kansas Colored Volunteer Infantry Regiments. Ozarks black history writer Isola Preston.
A black Union soldier named Crapple fought with the 3rd Indian Home Guard Regiment at Flat Rock on July 11, 1862, and he was also in the Battle of Prairie Grove.
Confederates regarded these African American soldiers as an affront to the old Southern order. Their mere presence within the Union ranks so infuriated rebel forces, they refused to treat black troops as honorable opponents. Confederate soldiers targeted black soldiers with a vengeance, taking no black prisoners. The rebels methodically and savagely slaughtered black soldiers. Reports of brutal war crimes were intentionally spread, terrorizing soon-to-be emancipated black communities. In the winter of 1862, a day-long battle took place in the western Washington County community of Prairie Grove. The last of the Civil War battles fought in northwest Arkansas, 11,000 Confederate soldiers clashed with 8,000 Union troops. By nightfall, both sides could count over 2,500 casualties. In late spring of 1865, families had to reckon with pillaged homesteads, scattered livestock, and neglected fields. Hundreds of emancipated Arkansas Ozark African Americans left the area, and within a decade, the county's black population decreased by almost half, from 1,538 to 674. Without an indentured workforce, the local economy of western Washington County also shifted downward. Washington County historian Joe Neal.
With the end of the Civil War, those economies changed greatly. The big farms, of course, changed tremendously. But the smallholders stayed in that area and worked them pretty well. In fact, many of the former slaves owned small farms in that area.
Many freed slaves, particularly the elders who had no means to leave and start a new life, stayed on with their former owners. They worked as sharecroppers on area farms, flour mills, fruit orchards, and cider presses, or found employment in nearby towns. Some former slaveholders, who had close ties with their slaves, provided them with land, tools, and seed to start up their own small farms. And certain African American families were awarded parcels of their former owners' property by the federal government, who sought to penalize certain slaveholding Confederates. Two of Mark Bean's former slaves, John Wesley and Eliza Bean, were able to purchase 22 acres and built a small community near Cane Hill. Dr. Gordon Morgan.
The black population was somewhat centered out in the Cane Hill area, but when the railroad and other roads bypassed Cane Hill and then the population started to spread and the black population began to move toward Fayetteville.
Increasing taxes, as well as the lack of capital for implements, stock, and seed, however, saw the demise of many newly independent black farmers in the Ozarks. Despite these odds, dozens of black families managed to establish themselves in rural western Washington County, among them the Lackeys, who traded properties, trained horses, and operated a grist mill, the Flowers, who delivered flour to area grocers by wagon, Tim and Maggie Deffenbaugh, who worked as a miller and midwife nurse, Frank Barker, who was in great demand as a butcher, and schoolmaster Bill Raper. In the late 1800s, two main railways were constructed in Washington County, which linked the western Arkansas Ozarks to the rest of the nation. The railways bypassed extreme western Washington County. By 1950, only one African-American woman, Addie Bryant, remained in Cane Hill, the final resting place for most of western Washington County's historic African-American settlers and their descendants is Bean Cemetery. Overgrown with fruit trees, rose bushes, and ancient perennial garden beds, the cemetery dates back to the 1820s Bean family of Cane Hill, the county's largest slaveholders. Malin Rice, a local newspaper reporter and former mortician, toured the cemetery.
And it has a large, as you can see, there are large stones, there's magnolia trees, there's hollyhocks planted here. There's even a bird bath. See the bird bath and the fountain? It is mowed, but it's not taken care of very well. But it's shady, it's nice, you can hear the birds back here. It's a quiet, quiet spot.
The Click. In the farthest northwest corner of Arkansas lies Benton County. Over 2,000 settlers homesteaded the lush prairies and forested hills during the 1830s. Subsistence farming and family-run businesses were the backbone of the local economy, with much of the hard labor accomplished by hundreds of African Americans brought in by slaveholding families, to what is now known as the Bentonville and War Eagle area, with the Adam Beatty and Martin May clans.
They came from Tennessee, and they just brought their cultural ideas and styles of living with them. They knew nothing else, actually.
Monty Harris, a native Ozarkian, is a self-taught historian and antiques dealer.
1829, Williams Jackson family moves into the Bentonville area, and they come in from Cane Hill. And they, when Dawson Jackson and Nancy Jane Harrell marry in 1846, Nancy Jane's uncle gives them 4 slaves as a wedding present. They can be followed and traced on up to their descendants still living in Bentonville.
The Jackson lineage is intertwined with 3 other slaveholding families, most notably the Blackburns, who arrived in 1832.
Sylvanus Blackburn comes from Tennessee, brings 2 female slaves with him. He settles at War Eagle and starts immediately building a very nice lumber empire over there.
In 1836, the Andersons moved in from Kentucky, south of Bentonville, into a place called Vaughan. In a few short years, the Andersons had constructed a large brick home, slave quarters, blacksmith shop, carriage houses and barns, were running cattle and hogs, as well as cultivating fields of wheat, oats, corn, and hay. Property records reveal that their homestead, one of the wealthiest in the region, was evaluated at $5,000. Calculated in this property figure were slaves who resided in separate quarters from the main house and were buried in segregated family cemeteries. At least 4 slave cemeteries have been documented in Benton County, among them a plot on the old Anderson place.
In the case of the Anderson Cemetery, all evidence had been removed by a previous landowner who wanted to farm over the area, which in my view is symbolic. This project was kind of symbolic of African-American history in the area. It has been somewhat lost in history. Had it been a white cemetery, that probably not had happened.
Jerry Hilliard, a station assistant archaeologist with the Arkansas Archaeological Survey, led a 1998 survey of the area in order to preserve the site from desecration. Hilliard's team carefully scraped away topsoil with bulldozers, then used hand tools.
We do suspect strongly there were no coffins in the graves that we did find. These were small children. They were just buried, probably wrapped in sackcloths and just buried in the ground with no coffins. Rather than continue the project, since the graves were very shallow, we decided that that was enough information to verify the existence of the slave cemetery.
The 200 by 200 foot historic site is now well marked and protected by a chain link fence. Along with several thousand whites in Benton County, 1840 census records counted 172 black residents, 168 of them enslaved. A decade later, 2 more prominent slaveholding families arrived, the Blackburns and the Van Winkles, who settled in a rugged and heavily forested region of eastern Benton County. Monty Harris.
They're all building little villages within on their property. And it's all the labor we can safely assume is being done, it's slave labor.
Peter Van Winkle established a company with over 50 hired hands and slaves.
And he's known as a mechanical genius, and he's building a huge mill. And his focus is lumber, while 3 miles over the Blackburns, their mill is for food, is for grinding flour and so forth. So we really have 2 different industries going there.
Huge stands of virgin oak, hickory, and walnut in Benton County supplied Van Winkle lumber for construction, railroad ties, wagon making, and milling staves for wooden barrels. Van Winkle created Benton County's early infrastructure, much of it with slave labor.
He built Northwest Arkansas. He built the roads. He built every substantial building in antebellum Benton County.
African Americans now comprised 5% of the county's population. On rare occasions, slaves were sometimes freed. The following Benton County document describes one such occurrence.
This deed of emancipation made and entered in open court in the county of Benton and state of Arkansas on this 20th day of October in the year of Christ, 1853. Between John H. May of the county and state, and Lewis, a Negro man about 6 feet high, of yellow complexion, about 42 years of age, last owned by John H. May. And in consideration of the long, faithful service to said Lewis, do hereby emancipate and set free from all his obligations of servitude as a slave, as fully as if Lewis had been born free.
Mid-19th century, the county seat located at Bentonville featured a two-story brick courthouse and small business district. The Civil War years devastated much of Benton County, considered a Confederate stronghold. In March of 1862, over 25,000 troops clashed in a two-day siege at nearby Pea Ridge, with the Union claiming victory. Homes, farms, and businesses lay in ruins. With the exception of Bentonville, however, few newly emancipated black families remained in the area to help with reconstruction. By the new century, Benton County enumerated over 30,000 residents, 112 of them African American. Bentonville's black residents purchased homes in the northern section of town, opened up businesses, and provided schooling for their offspring. Monty Harris.
The school was totally built and supported by the black families. They were very independent and felt complete responsibility for running the school as well as the three churches.
After enjoying several decades of emancipation and political enfranchisement, life for blacks in Benton County deteriorated. Businesses, theaters, and restaurants became off-limits to black patrons. In Bentonville and Rogers, the train depots built separate waiting and restrooms for black passengers. Many African Americans fled the oppression by moving north and west.
In Bentonville, race did not seem to be a problem, and yet in the other towns around, it did seem to be a problem. Why is that?
Although unsubstantiated by physical evidence, reports persist to this day of signs posted on the borders of such communities warning, "Niggers, read and run, and if you can't read, run anyhow." And "Niggers, don't let the sundown catch you here." A 1900 news clipping, which characterizes Rogers' lack of tolerance, is titled, "Realism of Town Pranksters Discouraged Negro Settlers." The piece describes an African-American brick mason entering one of Rogers' first drinking establishments, the Blue Saloon, in search of his boss, a contractor from Bentonville.
A group of young men were gathering in the Blue Saloon with a Negro in it. The group sees a Negro and began telling what they were going to do with him. It was suggested they drop the Negro in the old well after they had hanged him. But others objected on the grounds that the odor from the ones already planted there was becoming objectionable to the neighborhood. As some of the men pulled aside the planks to investigate, the ones holding the trembling Negro loosened their grip on their victim. It was a chance to escape, and in a matter of seconds he was just a blur over the horizon, and he never did return to Rogers. It was just another of the incidents that gave all colored people good excuses for not stopping here.
A 1907 Rogers City Directory distributed to potential residents boasted of its all-white populace as a lure for other like-minded newcomers.
Besides its convenient railroad location, it occupies the most desirable spot for an ideal city in the Southwest. This is made so by its altitude, which is about 1,400 feet, giving it a commanding and predominating situation, looking down and over miles of valleys covered with fine orchards of apples and peaches, strawberries, grass, grain, fruit, and poultry farms on the north, west, and south, and the most picturesque scenery of hills and valleys, watered by hundreds of sparkling springs on the east. And Rogers has no Negroes or saloons, nor gambling halls, nor a tough element.
A turn-of-the-century travel brochure for Siloam Springs, a community directly southwest of Rogers, also capitalized on being all white.
Siloam Springs, the city of national beauty. A good place to live, a good place to make a living. A city of industrial activities. A city of beautiful parks, many springs, cool nights, and pleasant days. Real hospitality. No malaria, no mosquitoes, no Negroes.
A rare newspaper article published in a 1904 edition of the Arkansas Democrat reflected the inner resolve of black Benton County residents during this period. The piece was a commentary on the death of the former Van Winkle slave, Aaron Rock Van Winkle, who had established himself firmly in Bentonville's community, but often traveled to nearby Rogers, which was gaining a reputation as being segregationist. Monty Harris.
Rock had been in Rogers on business, and in a joking way, one of our citizens said to him, "See here, Rock, you know that Sundown don't want to find a Negro in Rogers." The old Negro looked at him for a moment and then gravely replied, "Mr. White Man, I notice you Rogers people does a heap of talking about the colored man and says he ain't no good, but I always find that there are more Rogers people in the jail at Bentonville than there are colored folks."
Another obituary on Rock Van Winkle, written in 1904 by a descendant of the family who once owned him, portrays the racial climate in Rogers during this period, as well as subtle latent racism and paternalism common toward people of color.
"It is a pleasure to me to hear state that I have known this old colored man since 1855. Old Rock was one of the slaves of Peter Van Winkle before the war, and after the war he returned home with his old master and made him a better servant after the war than he did before. The weather was never too cold or too dark or too wet for him to get out of the bed and go on an errand for his master or for any of his children or grandchildren. He always had the respect and goodwill of everybody that knew him, and while his skin was very dark, his heart was as white and pure as any man living."
Young blacks whose families chose to remain in Bentonville were forced to leave the area for other reasons. Ozark's black historian, Dr. Gordon Morgan.
Big problem with Bentonville is when the teenagers became, courting age, they ran out of people to court. And because having been around that long, they all became kinfolks. And so you had to move in order to find somebody that you could court.
My grandpa Charlie Claypool was a slave. The Claypool, the name Claypool, it was his slave owner, you know.
Sophia Jo Black Hall, Jo for short, is the great-granddaughter of Aaron Rock Van Winkle. One of 10 daughters, she was born August 1920 to Eula Claypool Black and Virgil Black in Bentonville.
Our little house, I remember, was a three-room little house that my father built for his brood of kids and his wife.
Although her father died when Jo was only 7 years old, she and her sisters experienced a secure childhood with their mother in Bentonville.
We were a poor family, but for some reason we were a happy family, you know. I can remember the winter nights, you know, when it was all cold we had this funny little wood stove, wood or coal, it'd burn wood or coal, in the living room, and we'd get around that to be nice and warm, and we'd just sing our hearts out, you know, entertaining ourselves, singing, and popping popcorn and such things as that, you know.
Like many isolated black neighborhoods in the Ozarks, Bentonville's had a place name, said Joe Hall.
The Click. That was the black neighborhood. And don't ask me where it got that name. But that's everybody over in the west part of town coming to our section of town and going to the Click.
With her characteristic warm humor, Jo described how she, her mother, and sisters would make do.
We had rice for breakfast. And we had such as beans, and we had all kinds of greens, turnip greens and mustard greens, and you know, and chicken, pig feet. I never did like pig feet. And her favorite pie, raisin cobbler. And those, when those raisins swelled up, they always remind me of ticks on a dog. So I, instead of saying raisin pie, I'd say tick pie.
Each summer, Bella Vista hosted an annual Emancipation Day dance held in August. Blacks from all over Northwest Arkansas would come dressed in their finest to the dance, which also served as entertainment for white patrons. Circulated invitation posters read as follows.
Emancipation Dance, Lake Pavilion. Bella Vista colored employees and their friends, chauffeurs and maids. Black and Tan program begins at 12 midnight, featuring the Jitterbug and a continuous program of screaming, yelping, and crooners. Hundreds of white spectators attend and are cordially invited. 500 seats are provided at 25 cents each.
Joe's family would travel the 30 miles to Bella Vista to participate in the dance.
Of course, we were too young, you know, to dance, but we enjoyed watching the people dance. The party always went on to about 4 o'clock in the morning. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning when we'd get back home. There would be a lot. Now, that was a sightseeing thing for the white people. They liked to see the black people dance. So there would be a lot of people there, white people there, watching, and they had seating, you know. It was a, well, maybe it was a show for the white folks. I don't know.
One by one, each of the Claypool sisters moved away in search of education and work. Jo was the only daughter who remained in Northwest Arkansas. In 1937, she left Bentonville and moved to Fayetteville. 77-year-old Elizabeth Robertson is one of the last remaining descendants who still resides in Bentonville's historic African-American community. Elizabeth, along with her husband Christopher, reside in her 104-year-old childhood home, situated on a quiet, tree-lined neighborhood in North Bentonville. Her great-great-grandmother was Clara Womack, one of the slaves given as a gift to the newly wedded Jackson settlers.
The people that owned her, which every time I say that, it really gets me, were very, very good to her and my great-grandmother and the children. In fact, they treated them like they were members of the family. And whenever they bought for their children, they bought for my grandmother and her sisters and brothers.
Elizabeth believes that Northwest Arkansas slaves received more consideration than most people realize.
I've never heard my grandmother or grandfather either, for that matter, ever say anything bad about anyone as far as the way they were brought up.
Elizabeth's grandfather, General Clayton Gilbert, named after a Confederate general, was born a freeman.
My grandparents were the very first ones in this neighborhood. And my father married. My grandfather gave them the lot next door, and they built that house, and that's where I was born, over there.
After work and on weekends, Bentonville's black residents freely traveled the area to fish, hunt, and swim. The one pleasure the family could not indulge, however, was dining out at the downtown Bentonville Cafe, where Mr. Gilbert cooked. Southern segregation codes held fast, even in this tolerant community.
It really didn't bother me too much. I guess maybe it should have, but it didn't, because it gave me an opportunity to be more independent, I think, and it really helped me.
She later attended the University of Pine Bluff, then called AMNN University to study English and French, then moved to California to pursue a career in retail clothing. For most of her 70 years, Elizabeth, an elegant woman who appears to be in her 50s, said she has never been troubled by racism.
People are people. It doesn't make any difference what color you are or where you come from.
Mid-20th century found Bentonville's black district counting only 25 residents, a number that would continue to decline. The historic neighborhood remains intact and quite preserved, perhaps a reflection upon a community imbued with inner resolve and persistence of spirit. The Tin Cup. The passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution in December of 1865 once and for all abolished slavery in America. Southern white supremacists so influenced the American political system, however, that by 1883, the U.S. Supreme Court had declared the Civil Rights Act of 1875 unconstitutional. The passage of Plessy v. Ferguson decision of 1896 further rendered any notion of civil rights for emancipated African Americans into dust. Federally mandated segregation laws would create tremendous tensions and violence between the races for decades to come. Jim Crow, named after an antebellum minstrel show character, would stand as a late 19th century racial caste system of statutes passed by the legislatures of the southern states. To avoid Jim Crow, many blacks left the Arkansas Ozarks. Washington County alone lost 122 black citizens by 1900. Ozarks African American historian Dr. Gordon Morgan.
The black people of the Ozarks have survived very largely by not being recognized. The least amount of recognition that you could get for most of them, not all, would be better for them. Don't call attention to yourselves.
More than any other city in the Arkansas Ozarks, Fayetteville has maintained its African American legacy, a consequence that is vastly underappreciated. Joe Neal, who co-wrote The History of Washington County, is one of only several writers who have documented local African American history.
For simple reasons of justice, to act like this is a white person's area only ignores all kinds of things, including the contributions of black people from slavery to the present time.
For less than $250, black residents purchased small parcels of land in the Spring-Fed Valley and built Ozark-style frame houses with gabled roofs upon fieldstone foundations. Each room had an entrance to the outdoors, large windows, and covered porches where families and neighbors often visited. Shade maple trees lined the boulevards, and small vegetable gardens were tended to by each household. To educate Fayetteville's black children, the Mission School for Negroes was built in 1866, Arkansas black history writer Isola Preston.
The land was given by Judge and Mrs. Lafayette Gregg near the corner of Lafayette and Olive Street. And the first black teachers that they had was around 1898.
Initially spread over various sections of town, Fayetteville's growing African-American community concentrated in a valley of southeastern Fayetteville, referred to as the Holler, or Tin Cup. It is said that the name Tin Cup derived from residents who would stop by a local spring and take the water with a communal tin cup which hung from a nearby tree. Southern segregation codes were firmly in place in Fayetteville. The children of the town's black district knew from experience that certain boundaries prevented their freely exploring the downtown region. 77-year-old Lodine Deffenbaugh is a longtime civil rights activist, wife, and mother of three children. She can trace her family back to the maternal grandparents Ellen and Handy Slay and paternal grandparents Mary and Will Fisher, who arrived in Arkansas as slaves of the Fisher family.
Well, you know, a lot of cover-up then. You, nobody talked about this. Now, you could go, if you took your life in your hand, you could go downtown if you wanted to.
Dormant for decades, the Arkansas Ku Klux Klan experienced a brief 6-year revival in the early 1920s. Small chapters covertly organized in a number of Ozark communities. The largest was in Fayetteville, where 125 men and women were initiated in 1922 under a burning cross.
I don't know where the whites want to talk about this, but there were Ku Kluxers in our community. They would ride right up to your screen door with them horses. You know how they would make those noises, the horse noises. Scare me to death. I just remember Mama would gather the kids, you know, Mother Hen. She'd gather us and get us inside because she would hear them coming.
While the Klan claimed to be a law enforcement group sanctioned by a Washington County sheriff, their secret agenda was to terrorize Catholics and blacks. 34,000 people resided in Washington County by this time, 1,000 of them African American. Independent and enterprising, Fayetteville's black community saw modest prosperity and took care of their own. George Ballard, referred to by some as the poet laureate of the Tin Cup, was born in 1882 to former slaves who owned land in western Washington County. When Ballard came of age, He moved to Fayetteville and worked first as a barber, then later as auto mechanic. An excerpt from his book, Ozark Ballads.
A toiler speaks. I always feel proud of the work that I do. It's a kind that the public demands. I cannot spoil my complexion like you, for I am a dark-collar man. Although I've no hopes of becoming a clerk or to dress like the boss of a bank, still in labor and skill it was always my will to stand at the head of my rank. Although my face may be black as a crow and my hands be covered in dirt, it gives me great satisfaction to know that I'm not a mere collar and shirt. So give me the overalls, jumper and cap. Although they may tend to degrade, I have no use for the white-collared man who does nothing but sit in the shade.
Two 19th-century churches were established by Fayetteville's black community. St. James United Methodist dates back to pre-Civil War times. Located on Rock Street, the small, rectangular frame building is said to be one of the oldest structures established by African Americans in the state of Arkansas. Reverend James Webb, pastor of St. James Methodist Church, and his wife Emma established a cafe and boarding house in their two-story native stone home on Willow Street in the 1920s. 40 years later, the Webb's Cafe was taken over by Sherman Morgan, who was born in Fayetteville's Black District in 1914. Standing in the kitchen of his Willow Street home, Sherman fussed over a pot of turnip greens.
Can you see that? Got my bacon, all of that in there, and just cooking it down.
Sherman Morgan loves to cook, a skill he learned while working for many years at a university fraternity house and local hotel.
That's all we did, worked at the university in the hotels and shined shoes. That was all.
Sherman's grandparents were born into slavery, experienced emancipation, then lived well past the age of 100. Sherman Morgan was 14 years old when Fayetteville celebrated its centennial in 1928. Organizers hosted all sorts of memorials, including a float dedicated to the region's last remaining African-American slaves. Sherman Morgan owns a rare 1910 portrait of the five men, a composite created by Fayetteville photographer B. E. Grable.
They were all slaves. You can tell they are real old, people. Uncle Charlie and Uncle Sam. Well, Uncle Sam is my grandfather.
Written in ink beneath each figure, apparently by a white person, were the titles Uncle Willis, Uncle Sam, Uncle Charlie, and Uncle Nick.
Black man never was a man. When you're young, you was a boy. You heard white folks say, come here, boy. Oh, you was a boy. When you got older, you was a uncle. Then when you got older, you was grandpa. That's the way it was. You never was a man.
Born in 1896, east of Fayetteville, in the community of Harris, James Hoover was raised by his grandmother. Fanny Hoover served in the armed forces during World War I and came home to Fayetteville, where he married his sweetheart, Rissy, and raised five children. James took a job at City Hospital in 1918, where he remained for the next 35 years. Daughter, Teresa Hoover.
He taught us a kind of independence and an assurance.
Teresa Hoover is the 74-year-old daughter of James and Rissy Hoover. A graduate of Philander Smith College in Little Rock, Teresa later moved to New York. She traveled internationally as chief executive officer for the women's division of Methodist Church before retiring home to Fayetteville.
It's a kind of thing that we hear in, like, Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village. I think he had that principle, and I still see people who themselves are now grown in grandpas who are saying, oh no, they can tell you stories all over the place about Mr. James and what they did not do. But he was a gentle spirit.
Hired as a maintenance worker, James later became so proficient in medical procedures that he often assisted doctors. Teresa read an excerpt about her father from a bound Fayetteville City Hospital history.
Dr. Joe B. Hall, he says, James Hoover, an incredible engineer, innovator, stair climber, mountain mover, elevator mechanic, mentor, and more.
A hospital wing was named after James Hoover, which to this day serves as a nursing home for the elderly.
That was back in the good days, I'll say, 1945.
Louis Bryant.
I was a youngster then, over in Belgium, in the war, World War II.
As a member of the 306th Engineering Combat Battalion attached to the Army's 84th Infantry, Lewis defended his country in World War II's Battle of the Bulge. Lewis Bryant returned to Fayetteville in 1946, married his childhood friend Jesse Carr, took a job at Collier's Drugstore, where he continues to work to this day, and raised four children. Although Fayetteville's black residents tend to avoid talking about the issue, Lewis Bryant, a gentle and tolerant man, has troubling memories of Jim Crow in Fayetteville.
I knew things were segregated. I knew that. So me and three more guys, these three guys was in the Navy, and I was in the Army. Still had on Uncle Sam's uniform, you know. So they said, let's go up here at the bus station right up here. So let's go up here and let's see if we can eat here in the front. So are you game? Yeah, I'm game. Come on, let's go. I ain't scared. No. So what am I going to be scared of? I done been in the war. So we go up here in the bus station. Walks in there. The man said, "How you boys? All right. What can I do for y'all?" "We'd like to have four cheeseburgers and four milkshakes." He said, "All right." We sit down up there at the counter. And the people were just a-looking, you know. And we were just sitting there, you know. So they got our stuff fixed. Here we are. And I guess the man thought we was going to pick the sack up and walk on out. Well, we just opened the sack up and gave one this and one that. We come into eating, you know. And the man went back in the kitchen, called the cops. Big old policeman, he came in. He stood over there by the door, and he watched, and he looked and looked and looked. We just kept eating our hamburger and drinking our milkshakes and malts and stuff. And we were just laughing, you know, because we had made this up to see how far we could go with it. Before we got through eating, the policeman, he came on over. "Do you guys live here?" "Oh, yeah. Yes, sir, we live here. What's your name?" So after he got through questioning us and everything, then he said, he wasn't talking where everybody could hear him. He said, "Now, y'all know better than this. Y'all was raised here in Fayetteville. Y'all know better than to be sitting up here. You're supposed to go back there in that kitchen. They got a place back there for you all to eat. Don't sit up here no more. When you want something to eat, go around to the back and come in the kitchen." "It's okay, yes, sir. Sure thing. Thank you a lot. Just don't do that no more." "All right, we sure won't. Thank you a lot, sir." And he went on out there and got in the police car, and we came on out, and we just died laughing. You know, we laughed all the way. I said, "If this ain't a mess," I said, "here we've been in the service, fighting for our country, come back home and get all segregated like this." I said, boy, things has got to change one of these days.
After the war, the county's economy shifted from agricultural crops to manufacturing, food processing, and trucking. Driven by a booming poultry industry, much of it centered several miles north of Fayetteville in Springdale. A Springdale family by the name of Tyson, who were hauling truckloads of broilers and eggs to over 10 states, were destined to become the nation's most prosperous poultry business.
We were kind of fearful of Springdale and Rod, nothing black in those areas.
Lodine Deffenbaugh said she grew up avoiding Springdale.
They had signs around, so don't let the sun catch, don't go down on you in Springdale.
Susan Young works in Springdale as outreach coordinator for the Shiloh Museum.
We did an exhibit on cultural diversity in the Ozarks. Part of that exhibit also dealt with intolerance. In that exhibit, we had a waiting room door from a train station, and it said white waiting room. And that was a very powerful tool, especially with school kids, to be able to show them this door. This is a real tangible thing. Here is a door. If you looked a certain way, you could go in this door. If you looked, if your skin looked different, you could not go in that door.
Jesse Bryant is a Washington County judge and executive director of the Fayetteville Free Clinic.
We are a part of what Northwest Arkansas is.
Jesse Bryant, who has been critical of previous efforts to document her community's history, welcomed a more personal inquiry.
We have grown with it. We have worked with it. We've seen it go up. We've seen it go down. We've seen it come back up. We've seen the places that we could not venture into, the places we could not go or do. The circle has begun to come around. We migrated from other parts of this world, south, and we settled in the hills, in the mountains. The mountains are the most beautiful part there is in the area. And although we were denied a lot, we were denied to tell our story. We were denied. Therefore, the history that my grandparents, my great-grandparents knew and told to us has been suppressed. Now it can come to the surface and the people can understand.
Arkansas history professor Dr. Nudie Williams.
Older members of the community is reluctant because there are deep scars. They're in a survival mode. Many of them think, what good is going to do anyway? And it's a very difficult situation to get many people to talk about their experience because they want to put it behind them. And it becomes so painful, I think, psychologically, they shut down.
While most Ozarks communities would lose their black populations to race riots, pressures of segregation, or economics, Fayetteville's black community has remained stable and thrived. Lewis Bryant.
Here in Fayetteville, to me, seem like the people are more educated on things like that, and they appreciate the black community here. And we have never had no problems like other places have with black people here in Fayetteville. And the Lord don't like stuff like that. You're not going to be, when you die, you ain't going to get up in heaven and say, well, the colored's over here and the whites is over here and the Indians are here and the Mexicans are here and stuff like that. I said, we all one. We all one person.
You are listening to Arkansas Ozarks African Americans, 1820 to 1950. I'm Julia Rose Sampson.
Ozarks African Americans, 1820 to 1950 was produced by news reporter Jacqueline Froelich in the studios of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Narration was by Julia Rose Sampson. This history documentary was made possible through a generous grant from the Arkansas Humanities Council. Original and traditional music was written and performed by Chris Bradley with Chadwick Martin at Flying Squirrel Studio in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. To order copies of this history documentary, call 501-575-6408 or 1-800-522-5823 or visit KUAF's website at www.kuaf.com. Thanks for listening. I've been your host, Pete Hartman.